what's your guess as to the number of decibels of improvement, and what did that antenna location and antenna quality, what did the antenna physically look like that, that solved the problem? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, the kits that I've seen, Dick, that usually are sold for this are usually, they call them the 7 dBi antennas. Those are, sometimes they have a 7 dBi, they have another one that's called a 9 dBi vertical antenna. Whether these antennas really have this gain or not, I highly question, but that's the way that they are labeled. The other thing is that they usually come with a small cable kit that's usually maybe about a meter long, and I advise you don't use anything other than the wire supplied with this antenna, but you can locate the antenna. That's what's key. So, in other words, you may have to experiment with the location of the antenna, or the other thing is, if you can, sometimes just leave everything the way it is and just move the router. Sometimes just finding better locations for the routers will also fix the problem. You know, sometimes a repeater for the system will also help. So, these are generally the solutions. It's usually a repeater, a better antenna, or move the location of the router. KC2QIQ.
KD2AVU coming. Now, we've got a whole list of people here. Stand by. Bidirectional amplifier technique, where you really irrigate the building with a lot stronger signals from routers. That so-called repeater that you just mentioned, Glenn, is that sometimes called a bidirectional amplifier? Over to you, Glenn. Maybe Glenn got called away. Eric, I know you had a comment on this. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Glenn.
K2LIW, K2J. It seems to be something that you guys have been getting, and that is that each one of these nodes is a direct sequence split spectrum. It means they're hopping all over the place, and also the information is just, channels, individual groups of frequencies which are used by these devices. I've actually run into the problem with a bunch of microwave ovens, being in a facility where the node or the router or whatever you'd like to call it at that point is in a cafeteria, and it's actually trying to work with the folks nearby. And there are a couple possible solutions. First of all, if the node itself is located pretty close to the microwave, these radios, in essence they are radios, they're trying to get swamped. Okay, if the signal's strong enough, no matter what you do, you're overloading the front end. The fact that the spectrum offers a number of possibilities, whereas in one case I was able to find a channel that worked. It was sort of in between, but the receiver sensitivity was pretty poor because the front ends were being whacked. So, in many of the cases, what we did was we moved the node itself to the other side of the room, which was far enough away to keep the receiver from getting whacked. And generally, that's where the problem is, not the local PCs or wireless devices that were trying to hit the node. So the ones that were actually close to where the microwaves were operating, there was pretty much nothing you could do about it. In terms of using a bidirectional amplifier, well, you're out of luck if you've got it somewhere midpoint. Where is it?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Where you mentioned the front end is being whacked, are you talking about the client, or you're talking about the router itself? I guess it doesn't really matter. But by proper location, proper selection of the channel that you use, I guess by way of a spectrum analyzer, you can double confirm that your particular microwave oven is really on the right frequency, 24, 50 megahertz, plus or minus a couple. And therefore, hopefully, there's a channel you can find where you apply your spread spectrum, which is going to be a lot freer of that interference if one end or the other is not near a source of strong signal that's overloading the front end. Want to give us a couple more words on that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2YZ common.
Yeah, Dick. Most of these nodes are or whatever you'd like to call them, really don't have much of a front end in them. They're pretty much one chip devices in the front end, and, you know, there's the LSIs that they put together, and they're kind of a little susceptible to RFI, so really it's more location. You know, you can get that down to, I'd say, about minus 70, minus 60 dB, and they'll operate. They're pretty good, because the SPED spectrum, you don't have to actually have every single spike of the SPED spectrum being received. As long as you're not swamping the front end and causing all the NMR that's going on there, you stand a good chance of making it work. K2RWK, so thank
you. Back up. Okay, I'm trying to pick up people in order. There was another person who signed in, then Tim, and then Richard in that order. Who was that other person that I've forgotten? Give me a call, letters and name, K2LIW.
Kilo 2, India, Zulu, K2IZ with a comment.
Kilo 2, India, Zulu, go right ahead, K2LIW. Start with your name.
Dick, name is John. I'm just sitting here, and everyone is, you know, focusing on the microwave, focusing on the router the whole bit, but in my years of data in the phone company, we cleared up a lot of problems because the electrical outlet that everything was plugged into either had a poor ground or no ground at all, and it turns out that whatever it was somehow radiating back into the electrical system and screwing up everything else in the place. Just a question.
Back up. Okay. The next person on the list was Tim. Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Victor Uniform, K2RW. Go ahead, Tim.
K2RW in the group, KD2NVU, returning. Yeah, I was going to mention that I had some microwave interference before. On 2 meter, 432, and also my router at my house, and the person before me mentioned about the grounding of the power outlet, and it was exactly the problem, and because my house ground was attached to the cold water pipe, and but it was covered with pins. So I scraped off the pin and redo the connection, and the problem went away. That's the first thing I wanted to mention. And the other thing is, I don't know if the person has a problem is using a dual-band router. Maybe he can do some setup in the router to set it up to 5 gigahertz. If the problem is, you know, can be solved in that way. That's my comment. Over.
Very fine, Tim. Those are good suggestions. Yeah, 5 gigs would help. Better grounding will help. Better locating will help. Higher amplification. Bidirectional amplifiers. Better antennas. Did I pick up all the people who wanted to make a comment? I suspect I've dropped one or two of them. You guys knew who you are. Who else wants to make a comment on this? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
No, you need to worry, why?
Yes. Sorry about that, Joe. You signed in a lot earlier and I forgot you. To meet you all right, why? You got it, Joe.
The simple thing I was going to say about the microwaves is the one I happen to own is a fairly old one, and they are on 2450, but they seem to wander back and forth as they cycle. I mean, they put out a lot of energy on each side of that frequency. And the reason I know that, because I checked with my HB8594 Hewitt trace hold, and it's amazing how wide they put out, and they seem to almost simulate a spectrum type of signal when they operate for a period of, you know, like a minute or 2 minutes or something like that. So it may actually be putting energy out on the receive frequency of the node, and that may be a very, very difficult problem to deal with.
Yeah, you've actually made measurements now with a service monitor or something like that. If you remember, Joe, roughly how wide was the spread spectrum-like signal coming out of the microwave oven? Was the microwave oven half a meg wide, 1 meg wide, 3 megs wide? What did you see if you happen to remember, Joe? W2LYY, K2LIW.
coil looked like it was about 5 to 10 megs wide at least. Maybe a little more than that, because you can see the energy from 2450 going on each side of it randomly quite easily. It was definitely not staying on one frequency like a CW carrier.
You know, that's something that Bill might want to look at, because some of the inexpensively made microwave ovens have essentially no filtering of the power supply. The raw rectified, let me pick a number of 5,000 volts, raw rectified 5,000 volts with essentially no filtering, and it's got a whopping big 120 cycle component on, because it's a full wave rectified in some cases, that's being fed into the magnetron. So the magnetron is crawling up and down that sine wave, that rectified sine wave. The frequency is squittering, the power output is going up and down. It's only the average power that's cooking your food. But a particular brand of microwave oven could be so damn wide that trying to find a blank channel in the 802.11 spectrum might be very difficult. In which case, maybe the answer is to buy a better microwave oven. But Cold Spring Harbor, where you work, Bill, has got some darn good test equipment. And if you apply it to the microwave oven, find out what frequency it's really on and how wide. In other words, is it rape or murder? In other words, try to quantify the crime, if you know what I mean. How bad is those particular microwave ovens? And because microwave ovens these days, reasonably good ones, are not very expensive. You can buy a whole lot of quality Panasonic, for instance, for, I'll bet you, $150. So if they would just buy a better brand, maybe that could make a big clear cure. Before I pass it back to Bill, anyone else have any further suggestions on eliminating this electromagnetic interference on 802.11 frequencies? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. It looks like we've got most of the suggestions for you, Bill. And looks like you've got quite a bit of homework. Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, thanks, Nick, for soliciting all those comments. Replacing the microwave ovens is an option. Another option for us is getting, instead of higher power access points, higher power Wi-Fi devices, getting lower power Wi-Fi devices and putting one in every room of the building. Two-way amplifiers, I think, are not an option because they will tend to not be certified or take a lot of effort to get certification for them. I can do another measurement, I guess, with the spectrum analyzer, but that's the only instrument that we have, is that one device is PC-based using a PCMCIA network card. I'm not really sure the quality of the results of that.
Yeah, there may be a way you can borrow or rent a better spectrum analyzer and or service monitor to be able to make measurements a little bit more traceable to the Bureau as to strength and frequency and a squitter bandwidth. In other words, that microwave oven is probably being fed rather raw DC because it makes it inexpensive and the food doesn't give a darn about looking at modulated signal, if you know what I mean. It just looks at the average amount of heating power, that's all that it cares about. So to quantify it would be good. And by the way, there are commercial products of bidirectional amplifiers. You don't have to go qualify it. To my knowledge, it's an off-the-shelf item. I don't know the brand name, but I know that bidirectional amplifiers do exist. But putting access points in a lot more locations, because access points these days are not very expensive, that's another solution. Okay, anybody have any further comments for Bill before we go on? Give me a call that is right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
BGB.
Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, we had a problem similar to that with three microwave ovens. And what we did, we found the worst oven, the one that was violating the most. And we tried it in different locations until we found a location where it did not interfere. Then that's where we located them. And it's not convenient to do that, but that worked. Otherwise, we would have gone through exactly what he's talking about. So you may want to try that. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Dick?
Okay, another good point. Bill recognized another good point here, and that is that even if they're all the same brand, one of them could be a really bad boy. And so I am guessing, John, that you used a good spectrum analyzer to really measure how much grief each one of the serial number of the microwave ovens was creating. Is that approximately what you did, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Exactly, Dick. We had a small Tektronix spectrum analyzer, which worked pretty well, and one of them was at least twice as noisy as the others, and that's the one that we tried in different locations. We figured if we found a quiet spot for that, it should work with the other ones, and it did.
KC2QIQ is the comment.
Yeah, Bill wants to give us more information before I turn it over to Glenn. Are we forgetting something here, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW?
Not forgetting anything, but these microwave ovens, there's, more than 10 of them in this one building. It's not very big. It's used for work purposes throughout the day, not just lunch. And I was wondering, it seems like you're saying that even though this cloth is advertised for 50 dB of shielding, you're thinking that's really not going to work for me. Is that right?
The cloth is rated for 50 dB of shielding under a particular condition where you have a big enough chunk of the cloth and the cloth is in the direct path between the source and your measuring equipment, and yes, you can see 50 dB of shielding. In the real world, that signal is sneaking around the cloth by bouncing off the ceiling, the floor, the left-hand wall, the right-hand wall, the back wall. It finds 40 other ways to get there. And for you to lay down enough of that cloth, I won't say it's impossible, but it's a very tough way to go. Also, another thing is occurring to me, Bill, and that is you get a huge difference in the amount of signal squirting out of the door of the microwave oven depending on what the load is. If the load in the microwave oven is a real 8-ounce glass of water, for instance, I'm heating up water because I'm going to make tea. Let me drop. And those microwaves that want to bounce back and forth in that oven are really being absorbed. That's one condition. But if now I decide to, because this is an industrial environment, I'm not using it to heat my food, but I'm doing the equivalent of putting a piece of Tupperware in there to find out if it's microwave rated. And so I've got an extremely light load, a very low absorption material in the microwave oven. And now instead of the signal bouncing in the oven two times and being absorbed, it's got to bounce 200 times before it gets absorbed. The signal in that microwave oven, in that case, will be 200 times stronger, which is what, 23 dB stronger. So depending on what the load of the microwave oven is, even if the microwave oven is of good design, it's going to make a huge difference as to what goes on. So you might want to look into what these guys are really doing, and can you talk them into operating it with a glass of water in there simultaneous with the actual piece of plastic that they want to heat, if you know what I mean. Yeah, it'll take them a little bit longer to heat their piece of plastic, but you could knock the signal down by 10 dB by having them use it the correct way. I think Glenn wants to give some more information. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Very good, Dick. And I'm glad it was just brought back up again the second time. The point is, okay, this isn't one microwave oven. It's many microwave ovens. So you almost inherently have this spread spectrum effect because you've got multiple generators now. And they're not synchronized to each other, and they're all probably drifting around a little bit, and they're all on at the same time. So you've got quite a bit of noise there. What's interesting about this point is that this is something, a test range that actually Cisco had set up. Let me let it drop for a second. Because this was such a problem going back about 10 years ago when they were first starting to move the whole wireless thing in their product line, they started having these problems. And it's actually much more of a problem than you'd think. You don't hear it too often, but it's really a big problem. So they actually set up a range where they set up about 10 ovens, and they let them free run in the worst-case conditions. And what they found out, actually through enough analysis and enough measurements, with antennas were the key, that by putting a high-gain antenna and moving the antennas small amounts, it's amazing how all of that problem goes completely away to nothing. But it really is antennas and location of the access points and routers. You can fix the problem just with that alone. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, when he does that, it's going to get a lot of benefit. But considering the fact that you've got such a large number of microwave ovens being used in various techniques, I strongly recommend, Bill, that you beg, borrow, steal, or whatever, rent a reasonably good microwave spectrum analyzer that has, you know, good coverage of 2450 megahertz. With what you use as the antenna almost doesn't matter, as long as you keep using the exact same antenna. And now you measure, let's assume you've got 20 microwave ovens, and you measure each one of them individually, one at a time, under their working conditions. And I think you're going to find that your 20 microwave ovens, three of them are real bad guys. The door doesn't seal as well. It's been damaged. There's something spattered on the door, so that the choking mechanism for the microwaves at the door is not working as well. That particular user is using it for heating up a piece of plastic. He's not really using it to cook food, and therefore it's got a very light load and a very strong signal inside. When you make those quantitative measurements on your particular microwave ovens, you may strongly desire to take serial number 2 and serial number 13 and throw them out the window, if you know what I mean, and replace them because they're so bad, or re-instruct the people as to the proper use of the microwave oven because they're at the threshold of burning it up because they're putting in such light loads. There's a whole lot of variables like that that I guarantee you're going to discover when you use a good spectrum analyzer and make real measurements as to how strong is the signal at a known distance. In other words, sit the, let me pick a number, 3 feet in front of each one of those microwave ovens and standardize that and measure the signal coming out of each one of them. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNav.
KC2QIQ with another very piece of useful information here.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
If he does have access to a spectrum analyzer, I don't know what his means are right now, but if he does have one where he can measure the frequency, the antenna to use, if you can get the correct adapters and everything for it, is use the router antenna or your access point antenna. Screw that or mount that onto your spectrum analyzer. Try to get the antenna, if you have the spectrum analyzer handy and you've got the correct cabling with the antenna, try to locate the antenna as close to the access point where it's located with the router right in that one spot. And move the antenna around and see if you can find out what orientation of the antenna gives you the largest signal on your spectrum analyzer, because what I'm going to tell you next is a real beautiful piece of information. If you see on your router the polarization that's really giving you a large signal, find another location or a direction for the antenna and polarization that will change and drop the signal. If you do that in itself, just by changing the polarity or the location of the antenna in that orientation, may be enough to knock down the signal enough and basically work as a much more effective access point. And all you've done is just change the polarity of the antenna. KC2QIQ.
That's a darn good suggestion, Glenn. But it's one of the things that you tweak at the end of the process, in my opinion. I think he first wants to measure how bad is each one of the microwave ovens. Once he identifies the bad guys, and the bad guys maybe tend to be worse than the good guys, if they all differ by 3 dB, yeah, don't worry about it. But if you got one or two really bad guys, you want to find them and eliminate them or put them off into Timbuktu, then when it comes to orienting the router antenna, you're going to get, let me pick a number, 5 or 10 dB of benefit by doing that. However, as you move the people around the room, and people are reflective objects at 2 gigs, you're going to find that where the people are standing is going to make a difference in that test and in that performance in the real world. So it's a good thing to do, but it's not a glamour fix. But as you can tell, Bill, we've assigned a whole lot of homework for you to make measurements, do tests, try orientations, gain amplifiers, antennas, locations, altitudes, and polarizations. Other than that, you're going to have a good time. AC2IS, K2LIW, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, AC2IS here. Thanks for everything, Dick. My plan with the microwaves was to actually build a small tent around each oven. The load is something I have to look into. The load is essentially a petri dish with a particular gel in it. I really don't know how much that absorbs microwave energy or how well it does. What was the other thing? Let me break for a second.
Yeah, let me stop you on that one. It's a petri dish with the gel in it. I know what the size of a petri dish is, and that gel could be a material with a very good loss tangent. Don't worry about the dielectric constant of the gel, but it could have a very low absorption characteristic. And if you make that measurement with the petri dish versus a glass of water, you may find a huge difference in the amount of signal coming out of the microwave oven. In which case, maybe you want to try to convince the guy doing the petri dish experiment to do it with a glass of water in the microwave oven simultaneous with the petri dish. And the glass of water, by the way, if he's worrying about contaminating the experiment, there's all kinds of ways you can seal up the glass of water or make sure it's distilled water or whatever. On top of that, I'm wondering how in the world did they quantify the amount of exposure of the stuff that's in the petri dish when they put it in that microwave oven. Depending on the size of the petri dish, the amount of absorption of the gel, and so on, you could easily get a 100-to-1 difference in what you think is the exposure you're creating. And to try to quantify what's going on inside the microwave oven with only the petri dish there, that in itself is a very difficult experiment. If they're trying to do a specific amount of irradiation, that ain't easy. Over to you, Bill, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, I have no idea how much energy this gel absorbs. Their goal is to warm the gel, so I imagine they're checking, or if not every time, they check every once in a while with a thermometer to see if the time in the oven is really giving them the results they want. And I'm not sure I covered the microwave amplifier's comment, but my understanding is that an individual radio needs to be qualified with the antenna that it's going to be used with, and adding the amplifier will usually require a separate certification, radio amplifier and antenna. I think that's a really impractical solution. Back to you.
You're right. If you really follow all the FCC rules, each piece of electronics is qualified with a particular antenna connected to it. The bidirectional amplifiers come with their own antenna. There is a brand name, and I forgot what it was. It could be Andrew. Yeah, I think it was Andrew. I think the Andrew company makes a bidirectional amplifier with antennas installed. And the net result is that it's capable of really irradiating your building, to irrigate your building with a whole lot of 2.4 gig signals. And if you can boost up those signals enough dB, your life is going to become simpler. So I wasn't telling you to add an amplifier to your current antennas. Those bidirectional amplifiers come with their antennas, Bill. Need any fill on any of the other information you just received, Bill? AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think I got everything. Just one more comment to make in regards to polarization. And another thing that makes the amplifiers impractical is the radios that we're using currently dynamically alter the polarization of the output signal in an attempt to deal with environmental conditions like microwave ovens or what have you. So I don't think we can improve at all on the antenna polarization.
Yeah, I think you're saying that your system already is using polarization diversity, positional diversity, polarization diversity, and so that's going to be a tough one. I hope you're able to get a spectrum analyzer to start quantifying this, Bill, because with 20 microwave ovens and some large number of access points and some large number of clients, the number of permutations and combinations you've got is such that you won't live long enough if you don't start dividing and conquering. By way of a spectrum analyzer or service monitor, which has a reasonably good spectrum analyzer, by which you can quantify the real amount of radiation coming out of each one of those 20 microwave ovens. Until you quantify the individual microwave ovens in their normal mode of use, you've got to darn many random variables here. To try to hit pay dirt without that quantification is going to be very, very difficult, in my opinion. So I would fight for renting, buying, getting, stealing, whatever, a spectrum analyzer. Now back to you on that one, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Let's see, the spectrum analyzer that we've got is technically Fluke branded, but it's using a PCMCIA card that was manufactured by a company named Ubiquity, and that goes into a PC running software from Fluke. The panorama view on that spectrum analyzer only gives me about 2 updates per second, so the microwave energy interference goes on for long periods, so I can probably get a good reading that way, but just the slower heat rate makes me think that it's not the best instrument in the world.
I won't say it's impossible to do it with that instrument, Bill, but that's far from the quality that I think you should be using. You want a real spectrum analyzer that comes in its own shielded box. It's got a real six-sided metallic box, not somebody's motherboard with a plug-in card, if you know what I mean. A real shielded box where now, with a shielded piece of coax cable coming out of it and a clearly defined antenna on the end of that cable, you now can make quantifiable measurements of power flux density, milliwatts per square centimeter, or dBm per megahertz, or whatever. So, try to get a real spectrum analyzer, Bill. That's my recommendation. Okay, I know we've gone way beyond our normal schedule, but I think there was justification here. These are two fairly tough problems, and lots of people had some darn good suggestions. Go right ahead with the mailbag, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. All right. Well, I'm glad we're talking about shielding because I have a gentleman here with a question on a Faraday cage. He calls it a Faraday box, but you know what I mean. His question is, let me let it drop. His question is the rating of the Faraday cage. If it's 100 dB or 120, whatever that isolation is it consistent within a reasonable frequency band and the power band? If he has 10 watts inside of it and he reads X amount of leakage, if he goes to 1,000 watts, does the leakage increase or does the attenuation factor work through the frequency band and the elevation of power? Maybe you could explain how that works, Dick. Back to you.
When it comes to a good brand name of a commercially made product, called anechoic chamber, Faraday shield, screen room, EMI testing facility. Each one of these commercially made things that are traceable to the Bureau, in theory they give you a curve of isolation versus frequency. It's usually an XY plot. Horizontal axis is frequency, vertical axis is decibels of shielding. And it's done in a fairly standard manner where a known amount of watts per square meter is being emitted by a transmitter and a known antenna, either inside or outside, because of the law of reciprocity. Whether the source of signal be inside and you test what leaks outside or vice versa, that's your choice. There's pros and cons of each way, but once you get X number of dB shield, let's assume that your particular screen room, Faraday shield if you like, but screen room I'm going to call it. If your screen room is rated for 100 decibels of shielding for the frequency region of 500 megs to 10 gigahertz, had that rating of 100 dB, and you look at the actual curve, and the curve averages 115 dB, but there's one or two places where it dips down and barely hits 100, and they're meeting the spec. So with that curve, you know what the shielding is. The way anything that creates attenuation, let me drop it. Unless you get to the point where the signal you're radiating is so damn strong that you're arcing over the finger stock on the door. Until you get to that point, there is no nonlinearity. Same thing with a pad. If I've got a coaxial attenuator that's rated for 10 decibels of attenuation, and I put on a signal generator that gives me a minus 60 dBm signal, and out of the other end of the attenuator, I measure minus 70. I just confirmed 10 dB of loss. And then assuming that it's a high power attenuator, and I put 100 watts into it on one end, and I measure 10 watts coming out of the other end, which again is 10 dB of attenuation, any reasonable attenuator, as long as you're using it within its power rating specifications, you're not exceeding it, 10 dB at one power level is 10 dB at another power level. It'll always be cutting down the power you put into one side by 10 to 1 ratio in my example of that 10 dB attenuator. Let me drop. By the same token, a 100 dB screen room, whether the signal inside is a microwatt, a milliwatt, or a kilowatt, or a gigawatt, up until you get to the point of something becoming nonlinear, like arcing over the finger stock on the door. Until you get to that point, it is a thoroughly linear system. It'll always have 100 dB of attenuation at all of the frequencies over which it is rated, at all of the power levels over which it's rated. So attenuation doesn't suddenly go up and down, but you got to be careful now. The attenuation in decibels will be maintained. But if you start off with a weak signal generator today, and you get to 100 dB of attenuation, and you put a strong signal generator tomorrow, you're still going to get 100 dB of attenuation, but 100 dB down from a stronger signal is a stronger attenuated signal. The amount of attenuation remains constant. The power output of the leakage does not remain constant. The attenuation remains constant. I wonder if that makes some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
I believe so. It's hard to understand exactly what he wants to know about this, but, okay, the attenuation stays the same, but the leakage will increase. I think that's what you said. But the percentage of leakage and power should remain the same. Is that correct?
I'm almost positive you've got it, John. But I'm going to run by another set of words to try to make it a little bit more clear. The way RF works, whether it's an antenna that's transmitting here and a receiver that's receiving it over there with a receiving antenna, and a free space path loss across this town happens to be 100 dB. That's a real world thing. Two antennas, a mile apart, could easily have 100 dB of attenuation at a particular frequency. And now, as long as you don't change the frequency, but you change the power output of the transmitter, that doesn't change anything. The signal getting to the receiver will always be 100 dB weaker than what you transmit. So free space is linear. Attenuation of an anechoic chamber is linear. Attenuation of a screen room is linear. Attenuation of a fixed pad, an attenuator, a coaxial pad, is linear. So by linear, I mean, you got it right, it is a ratio. 10 dB is a 10 to 1 power ratio. So you put in 10 watts, you're going to get out 1 watt. You put in 10 microwatts, you're going to get out 1 microwatt. It's always the same ratio. Decibels are a ratio. So you're going to get the same ratio of shielding, but the answer certainly is you start off with a much stronger transmitter. You're going to get a stronger signal coming out, but it's still going to be attenuated by the same number of dB, the same ratio of attenuation. I'm pretty sure I said exactly what you said. Just trying to repeat it. A little bit like an attorney, you know. They use three separate sets of words trying to make sure everybody understands 2QIQ, KQLAW in the tech man.
KC2, WGB. Okay, yeah, I think that covers it, Dick. Very good. All right, let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next one. This is an easy one. Okay, I have a ham here who does a lot of sort of mountain climbing and hiking and stuff like that, and he was using his 2-meter rig with vertical antennas for a long time, but he would like to use it with a Yagi, but he has difficulty in handling the Yagi and just transporting it and all that. I wonder if you could describe to him what is meant by that folding, the roll-up tape measure antennas that you have spoken about a couple of times. I think he can fashion a Yagi out of that without any problem, and it's very easy. He walks around with a little pole, so maybe give him a quick description on that, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
There is a monthly journal called the RARA, R-A-R-A, Rochester Amateur Radio Association. And I'm pretty sure I sent you a copy of that article. And I'm going to dig it up again. I'm going to try to put it into Bernie's Dropbox. Approximately 6 months or a year ago, there was an issue of the Rochester Amateur Radio Association monthly journal. We're on page 4, 5, and 6, if I remember correctly. They showed you 20, count them, 20 of their members, young members, all coming together, building either 3 or 4 element Yagis, where the boom was a piece of PVC tubing, with a bunch of PVC keys in the middle of the boom, and that each one of the keys are where they mounted pieces of carpenter tape, expandable tape measure, if you know what I mean, mounted to the key with hose clamps. Very inexpensive, very crafty method of construction. And the antenna itself, because the tape measure tape, the pull-out type of tape, if you know what I mean, you could easily wave your hand over the boom, fold all of those elements down flat with the boom, wrap it with rubber bands or strings if you want to, throw it in the boot of your car, as the Brits would say, put it in the trunk of your car, easily to transport. When you get onto the site where you want to do fox hunting, let me drop. Get on the fox place where you want to do the fox hunting. You remove the string or rubber bands. The antenna pops out. It's a very light thing. You put a pole on it if you want to get slightly higher performance. And now you can do this kind of a fox hunt that they do in Asia, where it's a combination of camping out, orienteering, running through the woods, and whatever. You're looking for the fox, or you're trying to get to a particular location using beacon transmitters for orienteering yourself. These high-performance 2-meter foldable tape measure antennas, it's an extremely crafty design, high in performance, and very well documented in this issue of RARA. And I think I may have sent you a copy of that, or I know that we mentioned it on the TechNet. Too bad I can't tell you which exact TechNet it was, and I tell you now, you go to the website and go back to that exact issue. But it's easier to find that issue of Radio Amateur Rochester Amateur Radio Association, RARA. You go to that group, and you go to that journal, and you read those beautiful, and you look at those beautiful technical pictures, and you look at that diagram, and you say, boy, that's a great design. These guys are crafty. And so we got to find that one for him, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, I assume that's www.rara.com or .org. He could probably Google that, and maybe he could bring up that article.
I wish I could say I knew and that's what it was. The best I could recommend is if you Google Rochester Amateur Radio Association and or RARA, I'm almost positive Google will find it for you. And it isn't RARA.com or .org with www in front of it. That would be very logical. I'm a little bit worried, though, that There could be 40 organizations out there that would just love to have the four-letter abbreviation of RARA, and therefore, quite possibly, those letters were already taken when Rochester formed their website. Therefore, they had to add something else onto it. So, by way of Google, I think you'll find it. I just can't guarantee that you can go to rara.org and it'll be there. That sounds a little bit too easy. But we'll eventually find that for you. And lots of us should be using that antenna, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
That's true, Dick. It's a very convenient thing to carry around with you, even just to get it in the car compared to a normal Yagi. But using the normal verticals, he just didn't have enough power to talk mountain to mountain conveniently, so he thought it might help. And I agree with him. I think he's going to have a lot of fun with that. I'll try to find it on the Internet, and maybe I can send him a copy of the website, and he'll be able to access it. Okay, I got one more if you have time. A silly one, but one more if you have time.
Yeah, these are goodies, John, so we're certainly going to make the time for them. And by the way, if you're using a simple vertical before, and you go over to a well-tuned four-element Yagi by comparison, you can easily pick up 10 to 1 signal strength improvement, 10 decibels improvement, easily, and maybe more. When it comes to antennas with gain, it is almost impossible to get higher performance than out of a well-tuned Yagi. A well-tuned Yagi is going to give you the most number of decibels per dollar, the most number of decibels per pound, and the most number of decibels per square foot of wind load. Other than that, they're pretty good. And I really love Yagi antennas, as you can tell. Over to you, John. K2LAW.
Yes, and I like the way you test them. I am in the process of trying to get my other 415 working, which I drew out of the stock Connex box, and I found it wasn't working. I think it's just a dirty range switch, but I'll get that thing fired up soon. Okay, let me go on to this one. Now, I don't know if this guy's yanking my chain here or what, but this is funny. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, I sent you two emails today, John. The second email tells you that you could also use your 8405 vector voltmeter. It'll make a beautiful ratiometer, and no 1KC modulation is required. Over to you, John.
Dick, I got so aggravated at that, I threw it out. I just took it out and put it out in the garbage. So I have to acquire another one. So that instrument I have no longer.
Okay, you're going to the backup of the pair of 415s, and I understand. There may even be another instrument in your shop that can do ratiometry if you know how. The 415s into an A minus B scope can also do it. But go ahead with your next question, John.
You're exactly right. As we discussed, I have enough oscilloscopes to do that, and I can make it a standing instrument if I have to. All right, let me go on to this one. Let me let it drop. Okay. Now this young gentleman built an antenna. He wants to know what he built because it works really well. But it's a real Rube Goldberg. Okay. He's got two 200-watt incandescent lamps. They operate at 220 volts. Not that that makes a difference, but they're very large. I don't know if you remember what they look like. They have Edison base, and they're about three times the size of a 100-watt bulb, maybe four, and they're used in industrial lighting. Okay, he separated those two bulbs by 1 meter. He has the two outer edge of the Edison base, the neutral side, connected together with a piece of wire. So that wire is 1 meter long also. Then the two center tabs of the bulbs he has attached to his coaxial cable. He's using it on 2 meters. He has a reflection coefficient of 1.16. He's running 30 watts, and he's doing very well. He wants to know, what has he made? Have you got any idea how this thing works?
Yes, I do. And if we had to give it a name, it's a two-element interferometer. Each individual incandescent filament of each individual bulb is doing most of the radiating. Each one of those is a small loop antenna. So he's got a pair of small loop antennas inside of the glass bulb of each one of those 200-watt incandescents. He's got them separated by 1 meter, which just happens to be a half wavelength. And so broadside, he's going to get some pretty strong signals. End fire, he's going to get a weaker signal. It's a double bulb antenna pattern. And as you're about to discover, let me drop. Any leaky system that's not thoroughly shielded is an antenna. Now, this particular antenna of his might have a very desirable antenna pattern, but because a lot of his 30 watts is going into the resistance of the tungsten filament of those light bulbs and being turned into heat, his antenna might not be very efficient. It might be a 10% efficient antenna. In other words, 90% of the power is being turned into heat in the bulbs, and 10% is being radiated. That might be what's going on here, worst case, which is not bad. The average guy saying, I've got a minus 10 dB gain antenna, oh, that's useless. Nobody's going to hear me. Oh, boy. Because of the usual power spread of a transmitter receiving system. Let me run that by after I drop the machine. Assume I'm running, in this case, a 30-watt transmitter. I'm going to round off the numbers to make it a little bit easier, 40 watts. I know that a 41 ratio is 16 decibels. Assume it was a 40-watt transmitter. So therefore, 16 decibels above 1 watt. 1 watt is 30 dBm. So he is running 46 dBm. So his transmitter power is close to plus 46 dBm. A real good FM receiver on 2 meters has a sensitivity of probably minus 120 dBm. The difference between minus 120 and plus 46 is 166 dB. In other words, his transmitting receiving system can tolerate a power spread of 166 decibels. If he had an antenna doing transmitting on one mountain and some ridiculous number of miles away on another mountain, he's got another antenna, and if the free space loss between the two antennas, because of all those miles and trees and everything else, if the free space loss is less then 166 dB, like if it was 153, he's going to get a signal over there that's gangbusters. And so you can see that he might easily set up two antennas that are a little bit closer together so that the loss of free space is 100, and his system is capable of tolerating 166 dB, 166 of power spread. Power spread means the dBm of transmitter power compared to the minus dBm of receiver sensitivity. Let me drop. So in that example that I just gave, where he's got the two antennas on one mountain and the other mountain a little bit closer together, so the free space loss is, when I pick a number, 106 decibels. You'll see why I chose that number. 106 decibels of free space loss. And now he's using a really yucky antenna. His two light bulbs, and he decides to cover both light bulbs with tin foil so that they almost become shielded structures. So that now, as an antenna, it's got minus 60 decibels of loss. Really bad antenna. That's an antenna where only 1/1,000,000th of the power you put into it gets radiated. That's what minus 60 dB of loss means. 60 dB is a 1,000,000 to 1 power ratio. So only 1/1,000,000th of the power going into the antenna gets radiated. See, the antenna has minus 60 dB over ISO of gain in my ridiculous example of shielded antennas. He's got a 166 dB power spread system, and he's got free space loss of 100 dB. You put those numbers together, he's right at threshold, and it's going to work, and he's going to talk. Ain't that crazy? When you compare the fact that, let me drop. One of the clients I had recently was really fretting and losing a lot of sleep because he was about to go manufacture a system where each one of them had to have a little antenna on it, and it had to be a commercial product for a whole bunch of FCC qualification reasons and whatever. dB over ISO of gain, but it was expensive. And the cheapy antenna had plus 1 decibel of gain. He thought one antenna with 2 dB versus the other antenna of 1 dB, one antenna is twice as good, twice as much power coming out of it. Absolutely not. 1 dB of difference is a 30% ratio because of the way decibels work. And he was trying to overcome, in his case, he had a system with a power spread capability of 100 dB, and he's worrying about that last dB of a 2 dB antenna versus a 1 dB antenna. He was really missing who's eating his lunch, if you know what I mean. That company trying to sell him the 2 dB antenna with a whole lot more dollars was going to eat his lunch, and he thought he's getting a lot more benefit out of it, and he wouldn't. So if you look at the real numbers about the way signals spread in the air and the ridiculous number of dBs you lose for the first mile, and the fact that a receiver, a well-made receiver these days, can tolerate a small fraction of 1 microvolt. 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. So to find a FM receiver that will work very nicely at minus 120 dBm of signal is almost easy. And to use a transmitter of even only 1 watt of output plus 30 dBm, you've now got 150 dB of power spread. You can overcome 150 dB of loss between that transmitter and that receiver. Made up of cable.
Repeater, timeout.
You can tolerate 150 dB of power loss in my second example, and that loss could be loss of the cables, loss of the antenna, the free space loss of the environment, the fact that you're going through trees and a mountain and whatever. So the numbers in some cases are so big that for a person to worry about whether or not the antenna is 90% efficient or 95% efficient is really missing what's going on, if you know what I mean. So his light bulbs, which might be a minus 10 dB gain antenna, could be a beautiful antenna as long as he's not trying to run moon bounce with it where he needs every possible fraction of a dB because that moon is so damn far away and the echo you get from it is so darn weak. By the way, the moon at 432 megacycles gives you a free space loss of 263 dB. By way of your antenna gain on transmit, your antenna gain on receive, your transmitter power on transmit, and your receiver sensitivity, your noise figure on receive, you have to overcome 263 dB if you're going to do moon bounce on 432. Don't let those numbers scare you. But you've got to know how big they are, and therefore, if you can't, on the back of an envelope, write down the gain of your antenna, the transmitter power, and whatever, and look like you're coming close to 263 dB, if you can't come close, don't waste your time, because that moon bounce setup is going to take you a year of your life and quite a few $1,000s of your fortune, and if you're missing the target by 10 decibels because you didn't understand what's going on, you could be wasting an awful lot of money and time. Or conversely, because you know what you're doing, you may end up a very happy person and talk to a whole lot of people on moon bounce. It's a matter of getting used to these crazy numbers of real receiver sensitivity. It's an extreme...
Repeater, timeout.
It's an extremely amazing thing how weak a really well-made receiver can tolerate a signal being, suck that signal out of the noise, and give you some very nice sounding audio out of that loudspeaker. What a real receiver can do is at times only slightly amazing. KC2WGB, K2LIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick evidently had a lot of fun building this, and when I first looked at it, I thought he built a dummy load. That's what I thought he was going to explain. But he brought out one other thing, see if this makes sense. He tried feeding it with ladder line. He could not get a good SWR. The reflection coefficient was terrible. And then he tried 50 ohm, and it was okay. But when he went to 70 ohm, 72 ohm, it was 1.16. And, you know, I found that hard to understand with the tungsten elements. I thought he'd never be able to get anywhere near that. But he got it tuned up. So,